Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week we focus down on squatting with Joe Blake from Squash in London. Also, JFK Week, the 50th anniversary. We look at that. And Robert Turner from Western Zoyland down in Somerset. He's setting up an aircraft and aviation museum down there. But first, it's squatting, and we are happy to be joined on the line by Joe Blake from Squash in London. Hi, Joe, and welcome to Dialect. Tell us, first of all, what is Squash?
Okay, so Squash, the organisation I'm involved with, stands for Squatters Action for Secure Homes, and we're basically a campaign group who have been campaigning for the last couple of years, more recently, but originally set up in the 1990s, which was the previous time that the Tories tried to criminalise squatting, and we kind of reformed in the face of the latest attacks on squatters. And so I've been campaigning particularly vocally over the last 3 years as the Tories have been attempting to criminalise squatting.
I can remember a holidaying in Dartmoor a couple of years ago and going past a house with a plaque on it saying this house was built under the squatting laws in something like 1700s or 1800s, which used to mean that if you could put up a house within 24 hours, then you could stay there and live in it. But that's not the case anymore, Joe, is it?
No, sadly not. I wish it was that easy still. But no, things have got a lot harder. As I'm sure lots of your listeners will probably already be aware, the Tories, they didn't criminalise squatting entirely, but they've criminalised squatting in residential properties. And that new criminal offence became law last year in September, so it's just over a year now.
No, it's the first time ever in Britain that they've actually done this. I mean, it's strange to think, but even 5,000 years ago, you know, you could set up a shelter and it wasn't considered a crime. It's really only with this latest coalition government that it has been. Why do you think they've taken this move, Joe?
It's hard to see. I mean, a lot of their arguments didn't stand up at the time they were trying to force through this law. So what the government claimed was that they were bringing in this law to protect your ordinary homeowner. So to give a situation, you know, your kind of average homeowner who's gone out to get a pint of milk and has come back home and found squatters in the home. But actually, you know, what our argument was is that this doesn't happen. And in fact, there was already a very efficient criminal offence that existed before that prevented squatters from entering people's homes, you know. And I think this is a key thing, is that squatters don't just set out to go and take people's homes. They're looking for abandoned, empty buildings, as they always have done historically, to bring them back into use to make a home, and often involving very desperate, you know, homeless people who are just looking for a shelter, for, you know, roof over their head, pretty much.
Well, here in Bristol, we've got somewhere between 15 and 19,000 people on the homelessness register. Why is it, do you think, that... I'm going to ask you again, in a way, like, because you didn't really answer me there. Why have the government decided that this is such a bad thing? Are there some sort of financial motives? Maybe it's simply that a lot of Daily Mail readers who are homeowners want to see some sort of action against this sort of thing. Because it seems to me that they're kind of punishing people when they're really at their most desperate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, as far as we can see, the only people this law protects is property speculators and unscrupulous landlords. You know, what a point we've been making recently, since, you know, looking at some of the evidence since the new law came in, is that this was never about people's homes. You know, no one arrested so far under the new law was caught in anyone's home. It's all been empty properties, and lots of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of lawyers wrote to the government at the time as the law was being passed. So yeah, it's protecting property speculators, and it seems like there's, you know, it's not a coincidence that at the same time as all these kind of austerity measures are coming through and welfare cuts, that they've criminalised one of the last remaining options for people to gain a roof over their head. And as you say, you know, all the list, the homeless and housing list, you know, they're all full up. All the homeless charities are overburdened already. There's not anywhere for people to go. And it's in these sorts of times of housing crisis that people often squat, and the numbers of squatters increases, and I don't think the Tories wanted that.
Now, Joe, another thing is, of course, since the Second World War, we've seen slowly, well, really, maybe since the 1960s and 70s, we've seen a slow crackdown also on gypsies and people who are itinerant, you know, people who are kind of living in a caravan or whatever. And it seems as if you're driving a giant great Arctic lorry, that it's fine for you to stop by the side of the road and sleep there. But if you are actually in a caravan, it's not. Do you see, draw any parallels, as I kind of, I'm not quite sure, but I think I might be doing, between the clampdown on gypsies, itinerant travellers and squatters?
Yeah, I mean, there could be. There's been, you know, everyone, a lot of people know that it's very hard for travellers to get access to sites. And actually, there are some people who, you know, live quite efficiently in very small spaces. And, you know, in times of housing crisis, people get more and more desperate. So there's something about the housing crisis which is, from our point of view, it seems like an absolutely crazy time to talk about criminalised squat. It seems to be a crackdown on people living unofficially, if you like. But, you know, I think for us, squatting, this needs to remain an option, basically, in times of housing crisis in particular.
Well, we have a local newspaper here. It's called the Bristol Evening Post, or it was. It's now called the Bristol Post. And about 18 months ago, when these laws first were being brought in, we had a headline as well. On a Monday morning, the Bristol Post had the headline, "Why are they making it a crime to be homeless?" And they had a picture of a squatter on there. It was actually quite devastating. Went right around the city. A lot of people looking at this thinking, well, this is very strange. Of course, the thing being, on a Monday, back in those days, the paper was put together by people who weren't the proper editors. I mean, they're basically a kind of reserve staff team over the weekend. Now, funnily enough, they've actually completely changed the way that the Evening Post is published. They don't have a Monday edition which is put together at the weekend anymore. They have a weekend edition which is put together by the official editor and deputy editor and goes out over the weekend and also into the Monday. So it seems that the local paper itself is also quite sensitive about this. They don't like that kind of headline coming out. Tell us about how it's rolled out for you in London, there, Joe, because I wonder what's been the experience. Has this law actually had much of an effect?
I think the numbers of squatters arrested has been a lot lower than people expected. There was a guy called Alex Hay who was 20 years old, and he was the first person arrested in London on, I think, the second day after the law came in. And he was a young guy who'd come to London to work in an apprenticeship, and he didn't have anywhere to live, and he was squatting in a building that had been empty for at least 2 years, and he was sent to prison actually for 3 months. And it was definitely, you know, it definitely seemed like the government trying to send out a message there. But since that, no one else has gone to prison, thankfully. But lots of, I think over 90 people have been prosecuted now at least. It's quite hard to keep track of these things.
Hasn't there been a case recently in Brighton I was reading in the national press?
Yeah, and so more recently, in the last 2 months or so, there's been quite a lot of cases that have collapsed, actually. So about 4 or 5 cases now have collapsed because either the you know, people prosecution haven't been able to give enough proof that people are actually squatting in the building at all or actually living there. And the way the laws word it is quite vague, and there's lots of lawyers have picked this apart before. There's lots around the definition of residential, which isn't actually defined in law. So it leads to a situation where you have police having to make complex kind of decisions on people's doorsteps, complex legal decisions. And I think it's important to remember that the police were opposed to this legislation themselves in the first place, the Metropolitan Police, that is.
Amazing. Also, it's changed the goalposts, hasn't it? In the old days, squatting used to be covered by civil law. That is to say, the person whose house it was that was empty, maybe if they came back after a couple of months and found some people in it, then they would have to go through the civil courts to get them out. The big change has been that it's now the criminal law and the police will do that for them, but it's a very different type of court, because in the civil courts it's the balance of probabilities on which cases are decided, and yet in the criminal court it's beyond reasonable doubt. That's the phrase, beyond reasonable doubt in the criminal courts. And so, in a way, the balance is even though the court has changed, the balance has slightly tipped in favour of the squatters.
I'm not sure if it's... I wouldn't say that squatters definitely have a better situation. I don't think that's the case. I think that, you know, it was the law that existed previously. It was part of the Criminal Law Act 1977, I believe. That was actually quite an efficient law, and it was often very easy to get squatters out and quite cheap. So in a way, it has made it more complex in a lot of situations. And even a few weeks ago, there was the oldest council house in London was squatted, and because they were squatting as a protest rather than to live there.
Where's that?
So this is also in London, this is in Southwark. A bunch of people squatted this council house in protest at the council, all the council houses being sold off in the borough of Southwark. And so they'd been squatting it for 2 days, and the police showed up. But actually, because they told the police they were protesting rather than actually intending to live there, the police left them to it. So there's all these kind of complex situations that aren't... I guess they need to be kind of... They need to go to court for the judges to reword it and rework the law. But, you know, I just think the law that was before was adequate and simple enough for dealing with squatters.
Joe, why do people squat?
Why do people squat? I think there's lots of different reasons. I think particularly at the moment that most people squat, and particularly from people we speak to, because, you know, they can't afford to rent in London. Often vulnerable homeless people. You know, it's important to remember it's not just homeless people, as in the first kind of homeless people would think of, people lying, you know, sitting down, lying in the streets. There's also the kind of the hidden homeless. You know, people who are on friends' sofas, for example. These people, you know, there's lots of different reasons why people squat. There's also, you know, we've heard of all kinds of different people working in different professions, from nurses to teachers, also squatting just because they can't afford to rent in London. I mean, London's a particularly interesting example where rents have really become unaffordable for a lot of people.
Well, I can tell you there was you may have spotted this yourself, Joe, a fascinating article in the Digital Journal saying, are you working in London? It's actually cheaper to live in Barcelona and to commute by plane to fly in.
Yeah, I mean, that's really surprising, really. But when you look at some of the prices in London, it almost doesn't surprise you at the same time. The other point is there are over 1 million empty properties in the UK, and I think that's an important point to remember. I think people do squat for that reason, and I think lots of people have sympathy with that argument that, you know, why in these crazy times of housing crisis, why have we got 1 million empty properties at the same time?
Well, that's a good question. Why did people buy a house and then leave it empty?
Yeah, I mean, that's the real crime, isn't it, really? Not people making use of it and, you know, often bringing them back into use. Squatting isn't easy. It's hardly ever easy. It's often going into abandoned, empty buildings with no electricity, no water, and often going in and fixing them up and making them livable. I think this is positive activity to be happening in society.
Right, Jason, you had something to say about squatting.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of the cases that I've heard, they've been sort of... people moved into properties that have been empty because the owner's been a very rich person who's probably bought the property and gone and lived abroad, even though their office in the UK. They're interesting cases. I can understand a lot about it. I haven't actually been there myself, but certainly from the way I see it, the reason that the Conservative Party wishes to crack down on this sort of activity is purely because the people who are squatting aren't in a situation where the Conservatives can fleece them for money, which is what the Conservatives are interested in.
I mean, you're saying essentially they're maybe because they're poor and they can't be taxed, therefore, and they're not so-called contributing to the GDP of the country, therefore they're almost non-people.
That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying, well, that might be the way the government views them. As in, you know, the government will fleece anyone for as much money as they can get.
What do you think, Joe?
I think that squatters often save the government money. I mean, you know, it's direct action, isn't it? It's rather than getting on your council house waiting list, which, you know, and costing the government money in that way, or alternatively claiming housing benefit. It's none of these things, is it? You know, it's direct action. It's making use of empty buildings yourself. In that sense, it saves the government money, actually, I think.
What do you make of this talk about ethnic cleansing in London, moving people out who are so-called costing too much in housing benefit, actually out of London and to places like Manchester? That seems to be happening too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's terrible. I think it's awful what's happening in London at the moment. And you've got people who have lived in communities for most of their life but suddenly being pushed out. And I guess squatting is one option which allows people to remain in their communities and they've been in for most of their life. But, you know, it seems like there's crackdown going on from all different angles at the moment, and that's definitely one of them as well.
So, Joe, would you say this is kind of London at the moment is going through a kind of gentrification where it's just being made playground for the rich?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that appears to be what's happening. And hopefully, I mean, there's lots of housing groups springing up and lots of housing groups who are becoming more well networked together. And hopefully are, I mean, it's definitely an issue that's being talked about a lot in London. And, you know, there's things being talked about like rent caps. There's quite a strong campaign for rent caps coming in, which to me doesn't sound like a bad idea. We need something like that, certainly. Otherwise, it's just going to go out of control.
Yeah, Joe, give us an idea of what a day for a squatter is like that would be different from someone who's maybe paying rent and got a bit more security around their home.
It depends a lot. I mean, it does depend a lot on the type of squat. I don't think there'd be the same, you know, a common day for a squatter. Because, you know, there is a lot of situations where squatters have deals with landowners and property owners. They make a deal with them because it actually works out cheaper for the property owner, for the squatters to be there. So in that situation, and I've seen squats like that, it's just been very normal, very similar to other people living in rented situations. But I don't know, it's hard to say what common day is.
No, probably there isn't such a thing, but
yeah,
I mean, it must be,
sure,
I mean, possibly rather hairy the first few days you're in a place. The other thing, of course, is some of the big organisations, and including small landowners too, actually pay people, don't they, to come in and act as a sort of watch person on their house. I mean, seems like that's almost exactly the same as what many of the squatters will be doing.
Yeah, so there's a big new trend happening, again, particularly in London, and Camelot is a good example, because they're probably one of the most, well, they were one of the first ones to set up, and, I mean, they're not very popular amongst squatters, and I would share that opinion, because what they're doing, I mean, it's quite clever. What they're doing is they're basically profiteering out of the housing crisis, so they're basically taking over buildings that probably in the past would have been squatted, and then charging quite a lot of rent, actually. So, you know, not the same amount of rent as in an ordinary house, but it is less rent, which I guess is what makes it attractive. But they're still charging for places that, you know, would have been squatted in the past, and at the same time they're not giving anyone proper tenants' rights. So it's just like a kind of license, which is very vulnerable, and people get chucked out with hardly any notice, and there's lots of strict rules and regulations, so they're not great. Those sort of, there's another one called Ad Hoc, which is similar to Camelot.
And these organisations, do they basically pay people, and they have a kind of staff to go in and look after empty buildings? Is that the way it works?
No, they're the people who live there, who from Camelot, they're the ones that look after the building, and that's why they're called guardians. but they are paying money, paying rent at the same time.
Oh, I see. So they have to pay for the privilege, and imagine the landlord has to pay them. Crikey. Sounds a bit, that's a little bit cheeky.
It's very cheeky, and it's not so cheap. When they first started, it was cheaper than it was. It's gone up. So no, they're not good people.
No, I mean, what's it like living as a squatter in London at the moment, Joe? Because it seems to be so much pressure. As I was saying, people actually having to live in Barcelona and commute in by plane because property prices are so expensive. How do you survive from day to day? Actually, living in a city that's so expensive. I mean, just looking at your overheads of a week, I mean, you know, you could be talking about having to pay something like, you know, anything up to £1,000 a week just to be paying your rent and this kind of thing without actually having paid anything else. I mean, that's just a standstill.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy the amount of people's income that is spent on rent at the moment. And that is, it's a very new trend, really, you know, last sort of 5 to 10 years. You know, it's absolutely crazy, and I guess with squatting, what's happening there is that I guess squatters are finding it hard to find the right buildings. You know, whereas before you could squat in a lot of residential properties, empty houses. I think squatters are getting moved on quite a lot. So every couple of weeks, sometimes they'll be, you know, squatters will be moved on onto the next place, and you know that is very tiring. And squatting in all kinds of different buildings, from, you know, factories to old pubs, anything that is classed as commercial.
Amazing. Anyway, could you just... I know there's something called the Squatter's Handbook. Where would someone... where can you get hold of the Squatter's Handbook? Because that's got all the basic information about the law, hasn't it?
Yeah, if you're intending to squat or start up a squat, then that's a great book to read. And that's published by the Advisory Service for Squatters, ASS. And they've got a website and an office. So they've got the Squatter's Handbook. And they do a lot of the day-to-day kind of support stuff and information for squatters, whereas we're kind of squash campaign is more of a campaign, so we do the campaigning side of things.
Okay, and whereabouts else on the web, and what other groups would you like to recommend if people want to find out more?
So we're www.squashcampaign.org, and there's lots of information on there, lots of parliamentary briefings that we had a year ago, which are interesting to see the arguments that were put out. The Advisory Service for Squatters is a place to go if you want information about squatting and you want to understand the law a bit better. There's also the Squatters Legal Network, who have been recording all the data of who people have been arrested so far under the new law. So it's important to keep in touch with them if you're having problems in squatting as well.
Well, I'd also just like to point out, we've got something like 30 million people in Britain are landless. That means to say they haven't actually purchased their own home. They're still either paying off a mortgage or paying rent. So you're not alone, Joe. Landlessness is actually the most usual thing in Britain. And anyway, that's Joe Blake speaking to us there from Squash in London. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
See you later.
Thanks, Joe.
Bristol Community FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit, and we're now able to support local business by offering low-cost promotional announcements and adverts about your business or products. You can even sponsor a show, event, or outside broadcast. So why not support the station that supports the communities of Bristol? And contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community.
Well, it's the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the death of US Democrat President John F. Kennedy on the 22nd of November 1963. He was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. And I'm joined on Dialect today by two of the younger generation. I'm just about, I was about one or something at the time, but I'm certainly old enough to remember some of the fallout from it. First of all, you, Jason Yannakopoulos, what are your thoughts about the significance or otherwise of this anniversary?
It's very significant. JFK is let's hope the last president of the United States to be assassinated, and some even suggest he was the last good president of the United States, the last one that pushed for peace rather than war.
Yeah, certainly true. Duncan Bambridge, also, you're 26, 27, you two. What do you make of it?
I mean, obviously, it's quite shocking to hear when you're a young person growing up that that went on. I mean, there were a lot of politicians from that era as well. So, obviously, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey. It's not on, you know, it's in terms of deception, corruption, and basically, yeah.
Well, so you're saying you think deception was involved with JFK, Duncan?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of like a well-known fact in some circles, I suppose. It was obviously a strategic decision by some group, some cabal, for want of a better word.
Okay, Jason, what are your thoughts about all this? What was the reality behind the assassination? Who did it? Any ideas?
Well, there's many theories as to who did it. One of the theories is the Mafia did it. I think the most likely theory is somebody obviously wanted him dead. We talked a lot about Bill Cooper.
Oh, yeah, we were listening to him last week, weren't we?
Yeah.
He didn't do it, though.
No, but it's interesting. There's people like, you know, even there's people back then who, like Bill Cooper predicted 9/11, who were predicting that JFK was going to be shot. There was some people, I can't remember who exactly, but some people were saying that he was going to be shot. It's interesting Duncan mentioned Martin Luther King, because his reaction to the assassination of JFK was quite interesting. He said, you see what happened to JFK, that will happen to me.
And it did, of course. Yeah. Now, I've been looking into this and written some stuff about it over the anniversary, and also recently discovered this footage of an interview with a guy called James Files, F-I-L-E-S, who actually says that he was the guy that fired the fatal shot. I mean, it certainly looks a very convincing interview. And then when you check the people who were supposed to have hired him and paid him £30,000 to be the hitman on the grassy knoll, it surprises me that there's still all these documentaries around that say it's still Lee Harvey Oswald. Because it certainly, if you look at that angle, you scratch the surface of that story, it's quite clear Oswald was an agent provocateur. He was being paid by the military in the United States to pretend to be a pro-Castro campaigner out on the streets. And Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney, when he looked into the Oswald story, uncovered a load of intelligence files, basically saying that Oswald was working for the intelligence services, pretending to be a pro-Cuba person when he wasn't. Another very interesting bit of evidence is that provided by a woman called Madeline Brown, who's dead now, but she was the vice president, Kennedy's vice president, Lyndon Johnson's girlfriend. She said that he was involved, Lyndon Johnson was involved, in the conspiracy to kill Kennedy, and that he met the night before with FBI boss J. Edgar Hoover and CIA boss Alan Dulles at a party where she was. So the three of them all went into conference the night before. That's what Madeline Brown says. And if you look for interviews, I guess it won't be on the BBC, but on YouTube, you'll see her saying, "I want the world to know." Well, I want the mainstream broadcasters to honour Madeline Brown's wish and tell the world that there was this very high-level conspiracy. There's also a very basic fact that if you're going to do something like this, kill a president, then you need to know that there are various agencies that are going to help you with the cover-up. You need to know that the boss of the FBI is on side. That was J. Edgar Hoover, who was very anti-Kennedy. And you also have to have the boss of the CIA on side, who was in this meeting.
Alan
Dulles, yeah. Who was sacked by Kennedy. He wasn't the boss of the CIA anymore. But Kennedy sacked him after the abortive Bay of Pigs invasion. So there's lots and lots of evidence. I mean, also the fact that Kennedy virtually closed down the Vietnam War. This Vietnam War was part of US policy, and a lot of people were making a lot of money. Lyndon Johnson was a partner in a business which was there's a famous photograph, it's called the winking photograph of just as he's being inaugurated, Lyndon Johnson on Air Force One is winking at this Senator Albert Thomas. Well, it turned out that he was actually a business partner with this guy, and their company, Suite 8F as it was called back in 1963, was to go on to become one of the biggest military contractors the world has ever seen. That is Kellogg Brown Root, and they are now turning over something like $8 billion a year and annual profits. So no wonder he's winking, because he was making basically a business deal by killing the president.
So Tony, I mean, wow, I mean, Lyndon B. Johnson, the vice president of the United States at the time, was one of the people behind the assassination of JFK.
Well, he didn't do what Madeleine said was not that he did the planning of it, but he went along with it. He made sure that the cover-up happened.
He was involved in
it.
He
was going to make sure that the cover-up happened, and he didn't speak anything about it. Amazing. We've got quite a lot of interesting... I mean, United States was set up to be independent of Britain, basically to be a kind of a country where people's civil rights and freedoms were enshrined in law. And that was slowly been eroded. I think probably the most important time it was eroded was back in 1913. With the Federal Reserve Act, where the power to create money was taken away from the US Treasury and given to the Federal Reserve, which is basically a private cartel. Federal Reserve sounds like it's an official American government thing, but it isn't. The other thing, of course, is that George Bush Sr. was very much involved in the CIA, even at the time of the Kennedy assassination. Jason, would you like to just sum up for us what you think this JFK anniversary means for us today?
I think what JFK anniversary means to us is that, if anything, we need to know the truth. The truth needs to be revealed, all the confidence documents made public. We need to find out who shot JFK, who sponsored it, and who organised it.
The only trouble is that, of course, many of the people are now dead. I would just leave with listeners, do see if you can check out the Grassy Knoll guy, James Files, and see the interview with him, which was filmed in... Oliver Stone, who made the film JFK, actually visited him in jail, he says, on one of the other interviews. But he didn't actually want to be interviewed by Oliver Stone because he didn't like the guy. And that figures because he was a very right-wing mafia hitman. And of course, Oliver Stone's a bit of a Democrat and a lefty, so he didn't really get on with him. And he said, well, I'm not going to tell him my story. And he didn't want, Oliver Stone to make any money out of it. Anyway, that's our little summation of the JFK's 50th anniversary.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now down to West-on-Zoyland in Somerset on the Levels, where I speak to a chap called Robert Turner, who's just setting up something called the West-on-Zoyland Aviation Museum.
My name's Robert Turner. I am the West-on-Zoyland Aviation Museum Secretary. Say museum, we are a virtual museum, as at the present we don't occupy any permanent building, although we're hoping to achieve that eventually. At the moment, it's sort of based around a Facebook page, but we do, or I do, go out and give talks and exhibitions at local steam fairs and that kind of thing with our extensive photographic archive. This archive goes back to the 1920s when this was first inaugurated as an airfield here, where they would set up for a summer camp in the month of May, and this would continue around to September. And really it was Bell Tent City, because they had all the accommodation tents plus a huge hospital tent and these magnificent canvas hangars.
Sounds like maybe they had a lot of accidents. What was the hospital tent for?
They did have a lot of accidents, and a good few of our photographs are of aircraft that have turned over, because it's very open land here, very prone to sudden crosswinds. And the frustrating thing is we don't have any definitive list of accidents, and I can't think there weren't some deaths as well. Some of them, the damaged aircraft, do look as if the pilot would have been lucky to get out of it.
Now, on most of the maps, there isn't really any obvious airfield at West-on-Zoyland. And if you drive, though, it does certainly look like it, because along the main road that runs through the town and out to the east, you've got quite clearly the remains of quite a big runway on the left-hand side, which is all overgrown, but it certainly is a runway. What was the... you say it started in the 1920s, but just take us through the history of the place until it closed down in the 1950s.
Right, well, I've penciled in that in the very early days of the RAF, the Royal Flying Corps ceased to be as an organisation at the end of the First War and gave way to the RAF. So the Air Council, as it was back then, were looking for suitable land in this part of the world for an airfield. And of course, bear in mind that in those days it would have been little more than mown grass runways. These biplanes didn't need a long takeoff distance. However, it was linked to a gunnery emplacement at Watchet. What was going on was target towing, so they were linking with that in a great way, and that went on right up to the war years.
So you're saying that the planes would take off with something, sort of towing something behind them, and then the guns at Watchet would fire at them?
Absolutely. And you think, well, isn't that dangerous? Well, obviously the target was some distance from the plane. It would have been winched out on long ropes. These targets would have been the next best thing to actual aircraft, of course. This went on right into the war years, whereupon Western Zeeland, or RAF Western Zeeland as it was now, was extended. You couldn't actually travel along the road that we were travelled on, because the road formed part of the main runway, which a lot of people don't realise. You would have had to have gone through a diversion, which would have been in place for something like three decades. So this was effectively a no-go area completely. It was a shut-off village of its own, if you like.
It was used by some of the first jet aircraft in Britain after the war, but what was it doing during the war?
It was an army cooperation base. So we've got pictures, and okay, they look like they're sort of out in the roads, a bit like Dad's army. We had a permanent squadron of Lysanders here, which is like a monoplane, high-wing monoplane, multi-purpose aeroplane, which was used for a variety of training exercises.
Well, they were also used, the Lysanders, for dropping spies into Europe.
And now I'm coming to that, and that's exactly what happened here. I have discovered through one of the veterans who married a local girl here that there was an all-black Lysander specifically detailed to drop agents behind the enemy lines. And very shortly now, within the next week or two, he's taking me to a safe house in the Quantox where these agents were taken, either to be debriefed or get ready for their next mission. They had a system of dropping supplies and information without actually physically landing, using some sort of contraption which the Royal Mail had used before the war. So this enabled for quick deposits of material, whatever it was, without running the risk of being caught on the ground by tipped-off German troops.
So the idea being maybe to fly low and drop a canister or something?
That's absolutely what happened. They would, the resistance would quickly prepare and signal a landing ground. Obviously, this was done through GCHQ, Bletchley Park at that time, and they would have had pre-arranged deposits, perhaps sometimes be parachuting agents, picking them up, whatever was required. I understand this was going on from this airfield pretty much constantly.
So what about after the war with the jets then?
Well, this was put into what we might term as care and maintenance from about 1947. But what kicked off the jet age here was the Korean War. So there was then a very great need to train pilots from who that only had prop engines, different kettle of fish altogether. For many pilots, it was little more than a flying coffin. And in fact, that's what the Meteor was known as. It didn't have an effective ejector seat. Many of them didn't have an ejector seat at all. So they were very vulnerable in no-flying exercises. And that is why we have 13 graves in the Western Zeeland churchyard.
So what is left today then of the wartime and the post-war Western Zeeland airfield?
Well, we have a very active microlight flying club here, and I visited it the other day and had a wonderful flight up over the village.
They're a bit hairy, the microlights, aren't they? It's almost like you look over the side of your knee and it's straight down to the ground. You know, apart from the fact they're a bit noisy, it's almost as if you're just suspended in midair.
To look at them, they look like a high-winged monoplane. Don't think of it being suspended from a kite. I mean, there is that sort of microlight, but you do get sort of light aircraft feel about it.
But aren't they a bit like a sort of hang glider with an engine?
Yes, they are very flimsy. They're an alloy crisscross construction with canvas strapped around the fuselage. Is just sort of strapped canvas, really. And all you've got is a very flimsy Perspex screen between you and the fresh air.
But it's an enormous sight. I mean, it must be at least 2-3 miles across.
There is a lot of artifacts out here, I suppose, to be found. It would be nice to dig up some stuff and some of the other airfields that we are in the Southwest Airfields, which we're affiliated to, there have been some very recent finds, helmets and ammunition.
And what about things that are, places that are still in use, like buildings which are still lived in or that kind of thing?
Most of it, unfortunately, is very decayed, which does distress veterans when they've come to see where perhaps they spent some of the highlights of their life. They, you know what ex-servicemen are like. They hold their service years in great reverence, and they, some of them do have reunions. But one was seen emerge from these shattered buildings recently in tears, and somebody exercising the dog was, sorry, but what's wrong? He said, well, look at the state of the place. There's virtually no original buildings that have any practical use in this day and age. They are just what they are. The control tower is deteriorating beyond repair, unfortunately. The community hall is what was the wartime gymnasium and cinema, which serves as a community hall. But one part of this would have been some sort of admin offices, which is now the committee room, which is self-contained. And we are going to occupy that on special weekends, where we will be putting on special exhibitions.
Well, glad to hear at least some of it is still being used, and good luck to you. Can you just tell us where perhaps we can find you online?
We, at present, have a very, very active Facebook page. We're also linked with the Southwest Airfields Heritage Trust website, which I personally post on. And as we speak, a student is doing a project for us, and we hope to have our own website by the spring. Certainly on Facebook, you can look up Western Zorin and Aviation Museum and keep up to date of all our activities, which are ongoing throughout the year.
And of course, I suppose the other thing is you're constantly on the lookout for people who, with relatives, aunts and uncles, grandfathers, whatever that served here.
Recently, I've had discs of photographs and input and anecdotal material from as far as South Australia and Canada. And we're posting that, and that goes into our archive. I try to explain to people, look, an historical archive isn't set in stone. It grows, it changes, it's added to, constantly updated. So the frustration is getting hold of these veterans before they leave us and getting their stories firsthand. We're up against the wire on that, I'm afraid, with the time, because they're all in their 90s, a lot of them. Certainly the wartime veterans are. Not such a problem, perhaps, with the national servicemen, who've got many equally captivating stories to tell, of course. So, yes, it's an ongoing thing. I'm constantly going to see veterans, getting their stories, photographing them, filming their stories, and this won't stop till, unfortunately, the day comes where we are then talking to the families and, unfortunately, getting the information secondhand. It's a mission which we won't give up on, not only here but on the other airfields with a history in the Southwest.
Well, if you listen closely, you can hear the rain pitter-pattering on the roof there as I was chatting there to Robert Turner from the Western Zoyland Aviation Museum. And if you'd like to help him get a museum going down at Western Zoyland, or even just visit the place itself, there's actually a really nice dog walk and a lovely place you can go for a ramble. Maybe better to leave it till the spring, obviously, because the weather will be better, but certainly fantastic walking territory and some interesting modern archaeology. That's down at Western Zoyland near Bridgewater in Somerset.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos for our weekly look at the news. Jason, indeed. What have we got this week?
Well, we'll start with the story of a man named Rivers Pound.
Rivers Pound, okay.
This is the brother of Stephen Pound, who is the Shadow Minister for Northern Ireland.
Okay.
He's a 55-year-old, and he's had kidney failure since the age of 19, and his flat was one of three in a West London block of flats with a built-in room for dialysis. He's just fallen victim to the bedroom tax.
Oh, no. Oh, God. This bedroom tax has got to go, Jason. Yeah, what about, isn't it? Doesn't the Queen have a lot of bedrooms that she doesn't use? The other thing, of course, is that she has quite a lot of palaces, doesn't she? She got a pay rise this year from the civil list, or they don't call it the civil list anymore. They've changed the name of it to try and make out that it's not the same thing, but of course it is. It's just more money. And she's got, well, she's got Balmoral. She's got, obviously, Buckingham Palace, which she's getting revenue now from there because she's bringing tourists into Buckingham Palace.
Of course.
And then, of course, she's got Sandringham. She's got a lot of palaces.
Oh, don't forget, I'm from Maidenhead. She's got Windsor Castle.
Oh, of course, yes. Oh. So how many spare bedrooms altogether, Jason, would you guess?
Oh, wow. That is, well, especially even when she's not there, that includes hers. So
well, I think actually we should allow her a bedroom in each house, don't you think?
Yes, Father God, that must be countless spare bedrooms. God, that must be at least about 100.
Well, I've read somewhere that the estimate is about 700 spare bedrooms that she's got.
What?
And also, I don't know about other palaces. She's probably got like sort of secret underground bunker palaces as well somewhere. Okay, so that's that story. What about Scottish independence? What's going on with Scottish independence? Yeah, why is it that England doesn't have its own parliament? I mean, we also are starting to hear, aren't we, about city regions. Nobody asked me whether Bristol was part of a city region or not. I can remember there was a big hoo-ha about the whole business of Avon and whether Avon was going to be a county and Bath and Bristol were going to be run together, and then they decided they didn't want to do that. But the city regions, I mean, we're hearing about this more and more, but nobody in Britain has ever been asked, do they want to have a city region? And they're starting to become administrative areas where basically a city plus the counties around it. I imagine with Bristol, it's things like Gloucestershire, Somerset.
It's the old Avon borders almost.
Yeah. But the city region, no one's ever asked. I mean, this is an EU thing, of course, isn't it? It's a big business thing. The big businesses are going through the European Parliament and they're saying, well, this is how we want to run everything. This is like proto-fascism. I don't like the idea that all these big companies just simply decide how we're going to run our affairs. And anyway, sorry, I better get back to you wanted to talk about Scottish independence, Jason.
Yeah, it's independent Scotland would face new austerity, according to the article.
All right, so if Scotland goes independent, they're going to start running out of money fast.
The Institute of Fiscal Studies has said that Scotland's fiscal gap would be 1.9% of its GDP.
So does that mean they'd have about 2% less money than now?
That's over double the UK's gap.
Right, so they're going to start running
out of money. They would have to have double austerity, effectively.
But hang on, haven't they just opened a new oil field up there called the Kraken, which I thought was a very interesting name for a new oil field? Well, it's like a sea monster.
Well, rather unfortunately, it looks like a lot of the money is going to be put into the shale gas fracking.
Oh, no. So they're making profit out of North Sea oil and putting it into the fracking business in order
again, the problem with North Sea oil is the fact that part of that is still owned by England, so we still take our share. So if they get independent, we take our share as well. So it doesn't all go to Scotland.
Well, I'll tell you what would be interesting is if they discover Irish sea oil. I mean, call me a bit of a conspiracy theorist, but I think that these oil companies, they actually keep secret a lot of the oil reserves. And they don't tell people where the oil is, necessarily.
That's definitely true.
Is it?
I don't know, but I was saying it's definitely true if you look at the companies that are in charge of oil production, people like US Stand Oil under the Rockefellers, of course, these are families that are very well known for keeping secrets.
Oil concessions are very nice things for governments to hand out, and they basically make loads and loads of money out of them, but then they give complete control of that concession to the oil company. I noticed that the Israelis have been handing out oil concessions on the Golan Heights, Jason, which isn't even their territory, so that's a little bit cheeky.
Try saying the Israelis that one.
Anyway, on to Private Eye this week, and you've got an item on Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks. Again, we have to be a little bit careful what we say because there's an active court case going on.
This is a court report provided by Private Eye, and it's very interesting. It's talking about it being as open as possibly can. I mean, if you look through some of it, it's talking about, like, here they've got some of the things that Rachel Brooks has said that was used in prostitution. that she sent a memo out to News of the World staff that's quoted by the prosecution that said, "I hope you all realise it's inconceivable that a new or worse sanction these appalling allegations." Well,
which allegations?
The allegations of phone hacking Millie Dowler's answer phone.
Ah, right, okay, yes.
But it's interesting that she sent that memo to her staff.
What? Why is that interesting? Wouldn't you expect her, if she wasn't?
Well, it is interesting on the grounds that she needed to tell her staff that, as if she was trying to get them, if they were questioned, to say, no, she didn't do it.
Well, that's right. Actually, putting out a line to all the staff on a particular subject is a little bit like, you know, this is the boss telling everyone what they're supposed to think. And I think that's one of the big problems with many of our mainstream media today, Jason, is that the people who own it, that is, in this case, Rupert Murdoch, simply hires people who think like he does and expects everybody who's a writer on that newspaper or on that broadcasting channel just simply to think the same way as the people that run it and own it, rather than to have a good spread of... I mean, the only paper I can see going around at the moment, which is newspaper, sort of daily newspaper, national paper, is The Independent. Really does have a diversity of different views, and it has very different columnists from the right and from the left, and from the centre and from all colours. But most of our newspapers now, I mean, I suppose it's probably been true for the last 20, 30 years, do seem to be quite right-leaning. The Mail has gone... I mean, Sonia Paulson was a very good writer for The Mail, looking at human interest stories to do with people who are on the poverty line. She was just sacked. Also, protesting. What's going on there? Quaker, apparently, is doing some protesting.
Yeah, this is a really intriguing story. Lindis Percy, a 70-year-old peace campaigner who's a Quaker... She was arrested during the Olympic torch relay of 2012 through Harrogate in North Yorkshire. She was cut, bruised and locked in a police van in a scorching heat before being driven to a policeman and then promptly released without charge. She is a coordinator of the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases.
CAAAB. Yes, know them well. Yeah.
On 19th of June last year, she was holding an American flag in front of a guard of honour of US servicemen, an upside-down American flag.
That's right, because she lives near a US National Security Agency, and we've heard quite a lot about them since then, the NSA base.
She was snatched by seven burly West Yorkshire policemen, arrested on the spurious grounds that she might be a cause of breach of the peace. West Yorkshire police... Her complaint was about the way she was investigated by an inspector who is actually named in the article. That's Stephen Taylor. And this investigation concluded that the officers had a duty to act because some female spectators were concerned, asking if they were safe, stating that their children were frightened. However, after she threatened to take them to court, they found out this was not actually the case.
Yeah,
And West Yorkshire Police admitted to wrongful arrest, false imprisonment, assault and human rights infringement.
Hooray! Well, not hooray that they did it, but hooray they admitted to it. And hopefully Lindis will get a nice paycheck.
The private eye then goes to what may have been revealed in a court case had it gone to court.
Oh, yes, please do, yes. Carry on.
Now, the point avoided a court case which had been revealed how Miss Percy had been shadowed and videoed throughout by up to four police officers. Now, police video footage would have confirmed her treatment, but the video footage had been wiped because of, quote, user error, end quote. Now, there is no record of the existence of the terrified mother of the children, how police took no notes, how her bag was never searched, and how she was not cautioned. Had the case come to court, it would have been clearly demonstrated how the police had stifled a legitimate, peaceful process.
Well, fascinating. Sorry. Anyway, Jason, thanks ever so much for the news review. Really good stuff. And I think the other thing is to say about Lindis Percy, what a superstar. Her campaign, the Campaign for Accountability of American Bases, is one of the real basic things, I think, that we need to have here in Britain, which is, you know, that these bases are British territory, not American territory. And how fascinating that she was stood outside the National Security Agency's main base, Menwith Hill, in North Yorkshire, at the time when all this Edward Snowden stuff was hitting the newspapers. There she is, stood on the moors with a little upside-down American flag on Independence from America Day.
I think it'd be great.
It'd be great if some of our MPs would take a bit of notice and maybe even join Lindis Percy's wonderful little campaign. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can find us at dialectradio.co.uk every Tuesday evening when we go online. Thanks to our studio guest, Joe Blake from Squash and Duncan Branbridge, and also to Jason Yannikopoulos. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.